Please be seated.
We're back on the record in this matter, case number C4445. Martin, is it Kysak?
Yes.
Versus Valley Health System et al. Are counsel going to, and for the respondents, going to divide their time, or?
Your Honor, we're going to divide it as equally as we can.
All right, thank you. Counsel, if you're ready to proceed, and we note that Chief Justice Hardesty is participating by video from Carson City.
And if I may, Justice Douglas, I want to apologize to the parties for not being present, but I only learned yesterday afternoon of Justice Perigary's recusal in the case, so I wasn't able to get there in time for the argument today. Otherwise, I would not be appearing by video. I'd be personally present. But I can hear all that you say.
Mr. Shipp.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, good afternoon. My name is John Shook. I represent the petitioner in this action, Martin Kysak, who's present in the courtroom. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal. There are three issues that I would like to address today, and I'd like to turn directly to the first issue being the proper standard that was used by the trial court in denying our motion for new trial. This court in Cook versus Sunrise established the standard that prejudicial error exists when a complaining party provides sufficient record evidence showing that but for the error, a different result might have been reached. The trial court, in denying our motion for new trial, used a different standard. The standard that was used required appellants to show to a probability standard that a different result would have occurred but for the error. It's well settled that in Nevada, where the trial court uses an incorrect standard that may have substantially affected the rights of the parties, it cannot be considered a harmless error.
Mr. Shook, I'm a little confused by your reference to the standard of review of a motion for new trial. Cook doesn't even address a new trial motion. Our jurisprudence concerning the standard applicable in the denial of a motion for new trial is found in Southern Pacific and Edwards. And that standard of review is not correctly cited in the court's order or in your briefs. Would you care to comment on that, please?
Your Honor,
you agree Cook doesn't even involve the resolution of an issue involving a new trial.
Your Honor, it was my understanding from the briefing that Cook would apply. I apologize, I have not briefed that issue.
Well, you're familiar with the Cook case? You all cited it.
Yes.
Well, are you aware that the Cook case does not resolve a motion concerning the denial of a new trial? Well, let me ask you this. Apparently you're not familiar with it, but assuming for the moment that the standard of review as cited in Southern Pacific and in Edwards is the decision to grant or deny a motion for new trial rests within the sound discretion of the trial court, and this court will not disturb that decision absent palpable abuse. Could you frame your argument around that correct standard, assuming I'm right?
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree that abuse of discretion is the standard here. The standard my understanding is that the trial court was required to find under the standard that I apologize, Your Honor. I will attempt to frame my argument in terms of the standard when I get to the prejudicial error that occurred here.
Okay.
With regard to the error that were alleged to have occurred in this trial, NRCP 16.1 requires the parties to disclose witnesses that have relevant evidence, witnesses that have information that would tend to prove or disprove the allegations of the complaint or answer. Under 16.1, the trial court may impose sanctions that are just. Here, the plaintiff submitted interrogatories requesting the names of the parties of the of all witnesses, in particular the names of the nurses that treated Mr. Kysik and all of the employees that had information relating to the that had information relating to the treatment he received. In response to those interrogatories and in response to 16.1, the defendant, Valley Hospital, failed to disclose the name of a charge nurse that was critical to their defense. It was at trial in this case that the district court, in dealing with that issue, that failure to disclose a witness, allowed the defendants, stated, let me back up here. So in the trial, there was a witness that came to light that was not disclosed. We objected. We asserted that this witness has never been disclosed. The trial court allowed, stated to that we would be allowed to assert an adverse inference with regard to this failure to disclose a particular witness. Now, what happened was that actually at the closing argument of this issue, the trial court did not follow through with its proposed remedy. At closing argument, Valley asserted that because they were never specifically asked for the name of the witness, they were not required to disclose the name of a particular witness.
Counsel, let's go back, though, to the important part of that. We have a situation here. It seems that the jury was aware that some information was communicated to a charge nurse. It wasn't passed on. The verdict form seems to indicate that negligence was found, but it didn't translate into a verdict.
Yes.
So why is this important?
Yes. With regard to this, there was a finding of no causation. We alleged errors that occurred both before and after the charge nurse was relevant. The particular special verdict that we received didn't specify which breach in the standard of care that the jury found. Because of that, we cannot find that there was no possibility that the failure to disclose a witness didn't impact causation in this case. The jury could have found that the breach in causation or the breach occurred after the charge nurse on the 29th, for example. So moving back to what happened in the closing argument. In the closing argument, Valley asserted that they weren't under any obligation to disclose a charge nurse, and that because of that, they didn't have to produce the name of this witness. We objected to that to the judge, and the judge overruled our objection. At that time, he allowed Valley to explain that because they were never specifically asked for the name of the witness, they didn't have to disclose that name, and because of that, we were unable to argue and use the remedy that the court provided, which was an adverse inference under 19A, the instruction 19A. Because Valley was allowed to explain why it didn't produce, it undermined our ability to use that, and it also basically bolstered the Valley's incorrect assertion that they weren't required to produce the name of this witness. With regard to the second issue I'd like to address, dealing with the particular jury instructions that occurred that were given in this case, as you're aware, the jury found no causation. We proposed three jury instructions on causation that were not given. The first instruction that I'd like to deal with was a loss of chance instruction under Perez versus Las Vegas Medical Center. In Perez, a loss of chance is allowed where the evidence shows that there is a less than 50% chance that death or serious injury is likely to occur. In this case, causation was very hotly disputed. Their expert testified that Mr. Kysik was more likely than not, he he obtained his ODS, his severe brain injury, from multiple factors, including a low sodium, low potassium, things that brought him to the hospital. Now, why that matters is because he actually has ODS now, and because their experts said it was other factors that caused this ODS, the loss of chance instruction became critical. If the jury were to believe that Mr. Kisak was predestined to develop osmotic demyelination syndrome, and also found that the errors that they found substantially decreased his chance of recovery, then the jury would have been forced to find in favor of the defendant because there was no loss of chance instruction here. The loss of chance doctrine was submitted to the defendants in response to a motion for summary judgment on causation. They were aware that this was coming and that there would be a possible alternative theory in the case.
Was there evidence provided to support that theory?
Yes, Your Honor. Over the course of 3 days, we submitted expert testimony from our expert, Dr. Medias, who testified about all of the research that has been conducted on this rare condition. Osmotic demyelination syndrome was only discovered in the 50s or so, and he laid out all the studies on rats and things like that. It is impossible because it's rare and because it's dangerous to give specific percentages for a specific person like Mr. Kisak. We can give approximations, and the testimony was is that for each increase in sodium over the standard of care, that the risk increases and that the severity increases.
Was there an issue raised as to the testimony of that expert in terms of the before and the after treatment?
I'm sorry.
As to that expert's testimony, was there an issue as to care before and after treatment in terms of the testimony, the chances?
The testimony was he went over the studies that showed that the likelihood of developing osmotic demyelination, if you go over 12, for example, is that they get it 30 to 50% of the time. There was a detailed explanation of the studies that come into play. on that point, I'd just like to clarify that it was the testimony, it was undisputed testimony, it was the testimony of Dr. Medias that this did substantially decrease his chance, his risk of avoiding ODS.
You're at the three-minute mark at this point. Something else you want to cover very quickly?
Very quickly, Your Honor. The increase of risk instruction, we proposed an increase of risk instruction based on Section 323 of the restatement. Section 323 states that a party may be found culpable, may be found to cause an injury if they increase the risk of harm. In this case, we proposed an instruction that allowed the jury to consider that in determining whether a substantial factor existed. The trial court did not approve that. And I'd like to point out that this is important here because in medical malpractice cases, people that go into the hospital are sick. People that go into the hospital that are sick, they die sometimes. When you have a breach in the standard of care, it interrupts that sort of determination, that certainty, one way or the other, as to whether the patient is going to get sick or better. Because of that error, that blurring of the line, because of the error, we now have to consider the doctrines like increase of risk. The doctor should not be able to profit from the uncertainty that they cause in erring in their treatment. The final issue I'd like to address is the substantial factor instruction we proposed. We proposed a substantial factor instruction based on Prabhu versus Levine. This is an extensive substantial factor instruction. And it was important here because the defendants in this case argued that the sole cause, that in closing argument, that the sole cause, that we had to prove that the sole cause of his injury was the medical treatment and nothing else. They stated that we must prove the ODS was the rapid results of increase and nothing else, and that was the sole cause. In light of that, we requested the problem instruction. The problem instruction states that we have to prove, the burden is to prove that the error was a substantial factor in causing the injury. Instruction 25, based on the pattern jury instruction 9MM2, states that our burden is to prove that the error was the legal cause of injury. Prabhu stated that we're not required to eliminate entirely all possibility that the defendant's conduct was not a cause. But without that instruction, there was nothing else we could point to rebut this assertion by defense counsel. The defendants assert, respondents assert that we could have pointed to instructions 31 and 32 dealing with concurrent cause, superseding cause. Those two instructions did not apply in this case because they, by their terms, only applied to conduct between two negligent actors. Here, the negligent actor, there was no assertion that Mr. Kysik was negligent in causing his low sodium condition.
We'll give you 2 minutes in the rebuttal. We'll reduce your time, and I'll add 2 minutes to the time. Mr. Kennedy?
Thank you, Your Honor. Dennis Kennedy and Mark Hesiak from my firm on behalf of Valley Health Systems, DBA Valley Hospital Medical Center. Based on the comments from the court has set up the issues in the case quite well. I'm going to speak for half of the respondents' time on the issues that directly affect Valley Hospital, and perhaps, if I have time, one common issue. Mr. Frederick, who is here on behalf of the physician, is then going to conclude the respondent's case by speaking to those issues which deal with the physician. Number one, the breach of the duty by the nurses, Justice Douglas made this point, what difference would it make? And, of course, that is, in all likelihood, the reason that the jury reached the verdict that it did. To give you a brief review of the evidence, the opening statement made by the plaintiff's lawyers to the jury, we learned precisely why they were suing Valley Hospital. The plaintiffs, because the complaint is a general pleading, the pretrial memorandum is also general. It says medical malpractice. But what the plaintiff's lawyer said was, we are suing them, he said, for three reasons, but it's really two reasons. We're suing Valley because the nurses did not realize that the sodium level being shown by the lab test was inappropriate, and they didn't communicate that to a physician. That's the first reason. The second reason is that they failed to do a lab test at 8 a.m. on the second day that Mr. Kysik was in the hospital, that being the 29th of June. Now, this is what their arguments and their claims against Valley Hospital were. And they said, because you didn't communicate and you didn't do this test, this was the cause, at least in part, of Mr. Kysik's injury. When the physician himself, Dr. Lin, testified, he said none of that made any difference to him. He said, look, I got to the hospital, the test was supposed to be done at 8 a.m. I got there around 10 a.m., and I looked at the results of the prior tests and the progress the patient made. He was right on track for where I wanted him to be. And what he said was, there was no need to call me last night to tell me the test results. All I would have said is, good. I wouldn't have had you change them. And I'm here at 10 a.m., you haven't done the 8 a.m. test? That's fine. Let me just look at what I see from the record. This guy is right on track. And Dr. Lin then said, we don't have to do tests every 6 hours anymore. We'll do them once every 24 hours because he's trending exactly where I want him to be. So the argument to the jury is Valley Hospital breached its duty. It didn't communicate with the doctor the test results at night, and it didn't do the 8 a.m. test. Jury came back and said, now, breached your duty there on those two things. Should have done both of those. But then it found no causation. No doubt because of Dr. Lynn's testimony, and Dr. Lynn said unequivocally, wouldn't have made any difference to me. The guy was doing just what I wanted him to do. In fact, after I looked at these results, I said, we don't have to do tests anymore every 6 hours, just every 24 hours, because the guy is trending right where I want him to be. So that's the first issue, and of course, this goes, I guess, to the appellant's argument on the jury instructions. We should have had other jury instructions, and those instructions didn't go to duty. They went to causation. Those were the instructions on loss of chance, increase of risk. That wouldn't make any difference here. As I think Justice Douglas pointed out, it wouldn't matter because the jury found there is no causation here. While there may have been these two breaches of duty based on the doctor's testimony, there's no causation. So if the motion for a new trial is based in part on the failure to get these two jury instructions, or the third jury instruction causation, it doesn't matter. Because that's what Judge Corey essentially said, look, it doesn't matter. How is the result going to be any different? They found there isn't any causation. The second point, failure to disclose the charge nurse. Here's what happened. This ended up being a big fight at the trial. As in all medical malpractice cases, the medical record is produced. And the medical record contains no indication of the charge nurse who was on shift that night, the nurse who's in the supervisory position, of having done anything. Because as we all know, if that charge nurse did something, it would be in the chart. Nothing in there. The discovery that was done said, give us the names of the nurses who rendered care to this patient. Well, the charge nurse is not on there because the charge nurse is not in the medical record. Then what happens at trial is, and this is very important, Valley Hospital doesn't try to put this evidence on with the charge nurse. The nurse who was actually rendering the care is asked by the plaintiff, did you tell the charge nurse about the patient's results and the lab results? And the nurse, Ms. Buenafort, says, I don't recall. I assume the charge nurse knew what was going on. And then, of course, there's a big fight over why didn't you disclose the charge nurse? Well, the charge nurse never rendered any care, may or may not have known what was going on. But in the end, once again, it doesn't matter. That's a duty question. Did you tell the charge nurse or didn't you tell the charge nurse? As it turns out, the jury found you didn't fulfill your duty. But there's no causation, so it would make no difference at all if the charge nurse said, yes, I knew about this. Because remember, the doctor said, didn't matter to me what they were talking about because the care was appropriate for this patient. And that's the second point is the motion for new trial insofar as it goes to the failure to disclose the charge nurse. That's a completely harmless error. Judge Corey, however, did, under Rule 37, give the appropriate remedy. He said to Valley Hospital, well, you can't call the charge nurse at trial because you didn't disclose her. And the hospital said, that's fine because we're not going to call her. To our knowledge, she didn't have anything to do with the care other than supervision. And secondly, he allowed the plaintiff to make a comment to the jury, and they got jury instruction 19A that talked about an inference that can be drawn from failing to disclose. And he did, however, say that, you know, Valley could also speak to that point. And that was the proper remedy under Rule 37 if the charge nurse should have been disclosed in the first instance, which Judge Corey apparently thought that should have happened. Those are the two issues with respect to Valley. Are the nursing care and the failure to disclose the charge nurse. The other big issue, of course, is the loss of chance doctrine.
Before you get totally to that, even though that's, and you may want to do it before or after, but Justice Hardesty raised the point as to the new trial and standard. Do you have any comment?
Yeah, I do. We said in the brief that where you're objecting to a jury instruction and a new trial is going to be granted, here's the standard that ought to be applied. And in Cook, what happened was there was a fight over the jury instruction, and the result in the case was it was remanded for a new trial. I don't disagree with anything that Justice Hardesty said, but we used Cook because it was a dispute over a jury instruction. And then the Supreme Court said, and we'll send it back for a new trial. So that's why we used it.
Well, but in the sentence quoted from Kirk, the court goes on to clarify Carver and says that showing sufficient evidence, record evidence, to secure a new trial is not the rule. It must be shown that the instruction is not only erroneous, it was prejudicial. So the interesting citation to the rule is that in the very next paragraph, it's modified by the court in Cook. But in any event,
okay, if there are no further questions, I'll yield the podium to Ms. Schreiber.
And it pleases the court, David Frederick, with me is Kim Mandelbaum and William Maupin on behalf of Dr. Lim. Let me respond to Justice Hardesty's concern and comment. One of the problems here is that Cook does involve a jury instruction that was given but alleged to be erroneous and prejudicial. In this case, where the jury instruction issue involves instructions that were not given. And it is quite true that the review of a new trial motion is on an abuse of discretion. But the reason we used Cook is because Cook enunciates the standard of when either the giving or the failure to give an instruction is prejudicial. And it's worth pointing out, because this is a debate in the briefs, that both the majority and the dissent in Cook use not the might have been a different result, but the probability of a different result. So that when the plaintiff attempts to take one sentence out of context in Cook, doing so ignores both what was done in Cook itself, the precedents on which Cook relies, and the subsequent FH1 case, which again repeats the probability standard. Now, what I want to talk about here is the jury instruction issue. And I think there are two things that the court needs to keep in mind. One of them is that in Perez, the court adopted the loss of chance doctrine to provide a remedy for patients whose chance of recovery was already 50% or less. That's not the case that was tried by the plaintiff here. That was never asserted, and there's certainly no expert testimony to establish that predicate. More importantly, in Perez, the court held the loss of chance doctrine gets you past summary judgment. No longer can a defendant simply throw you out of court without getting to the jury by simply saying, well, if your chance of recovery is 50% or less, you can't meet the more probable than not standard. The court said the same thing in rejecting a demand for an increase in risk instruction in the Beatty versus Thomas case. Again, the court said the function of these doctrines is to get you to the jury. And in Perez, it was very clear that once you get to the jury, then you must produce evidence, and the court used the word specific percentages in the reduction, the loss of chance for which you're seeking recovery, and why. The court did that because those specific percentages then become the means of calculating the discounted damages that a plaintiff can recover in a loss of chance or increased risk of harm case.
Again, no evidence. That's not the case the plaintiff tried. That's not the evidence that was produced. And there is no evidence in the record that would allow the Perez loss of chance doctrine to be applied. Second important fact with respect to these loss of chance instructions. There are numerous cases, the most prominent of which is a case called Thompson versus Sun City Community Hospital from the Supreme Court of Arizona, that make it very clear that if you have a substantial factor causation instruction that is given to the jury, you do not need separate loss of chance instructions. And as a matter of fact, those separate loss of chance increased risk of harm instructions should not be given. Now, why? The reason is if the jury can find for liability that the physician's malpractice is merely a substantial factor, you don't have the more probable than not proof problem, which was the very reason that Perez was adopted. Not only Thompson, but you can see the same substantial factor principles operating in the line of Pennsylvania cases that the plaintiff cites in their reply brief, most notably the case of Jones versus Montefiore Hospital, where the court, first of all, identifies and cites precedents for the substantial factor causation principle, then proceeds to note, and actually quotes, the instructions that were in fact given to the jury, which did not embody the substantial factor causation principle, and reversed and remanded for a new trial. Here the jury was instructed on substantial factor causation, and I'll get to that in a moment. That instruction about which the plaintiff complains is in effect duplicated in numerous other instructions. The sole cause argument about which the plaintiff complains could have been answered by pointing simply to the substantial factor causation instruction itself. It doesn't have to be the sole cause. It only has to be a substantial factor. And if it is a substantial factor, there can be liability. Here, the jury looked at the evidence. This was a very conscientious jury. Looked at the evidence, carefully discriminated, accepting the plaintiff's expert's evidence on conduct below the standard of care, but then asking the question, all right, was that conduct a substantial factor in the patient's development of ODS? And answered that question in the negative. That is a jury verdict that's amply supported by the evidence in the record. It was the jury system functioning at its best. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schick, we went a little over. We'll give you a full 3 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to just clarify that the Cook standard was the standard that the trial court used in denying our motion for new trial. They specifically noted the Cook standard in the denial. If it was the wrong standard, the court used the wrong standard in denying our motion for new trial. With regard to the material witness, this charge nurse, the testimony of their expert was that the charge nurse knew what was going on, that the charge nurse is on the floor. The charge nurse knew about these particular test results. And because of that, they weren't required, Valley was not required to call the doctor. That was a primary part of their defense, and they never disclosed the charge nurse, even though we asked for it. Now, here, the respondents state that the Dr. Lim would not have changed his result. In fact, it was Dr. Lim's partner who was on duty at the night, on the 28th. Dr. Lim's partner testified at trial that he would have changed if he had been called. He said he was trying to avoid ODS. He was the one that was that said you've got to go slower and would have reduced it down if he had been told. It clearly would have made a difference if they had told him. Now, with regard to the lack of certainty, with regard to particular damages, this court in Levitt versus Leisure Sports Incorporated, 103 Nevada, 81, states that the recovery of uncertain damages is generally directed against uncertainty as to the existence or cause of damage rather than to the measure or extent. Once you find a breach, it doesn't lie in the mouth of the defendant to say you can't prove exactly how much, so you don't get anything. That is not the law. That's not what Perez stood for either. Based on that, we would ask for a reversal.
Thank you. The court this day thanks the parties for their briefing and their arguments today. They were enlightening and clarified some issues. With that, this matter stands submitted. We stand in recess of the call of the court tomorrow. Thank you.